consequences. I think I'm losing my voice a little bit today, but I'll hang in there. Consequences. Well, it might surprise you to learn that the bully I faced in school still takes my lunch money. Mm-hmm. Mind you, he makes a great sandwich at Subway. Did you have a bully growing up? Or were you bullied at some time in your life? Even as adults, we can still get bullied. We can get bullied by employers and neighbors and even family members. With the onset of the internet, something called cyberbullying has become a real threat to young people's mental health in particular. Do you remember years ago what you were told to do when someone was taunting you or bullying you? Do you remember? Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Remember that? You've probably heard it many times. Maybe you've used it a few times. When I was growing up, that was the standard playground retort when someone insulted you. There's a problem with that phrase, though, isn't there? We all know that those words are simply a bluff. They're empty. They had as much value as the rhyme itself, because words have a tremendous capacity to hurt even greater than sticks and stones sometimes. I'm sure, looking around this room today, that there are people here who are still bearing the scars of things that people have said to them in the past, maybe even a long way back in the past. Not that all words of insult hurt as much as others, do they? Words that kind of come out as a slip of the tongue are not nearly as painful as those that are clearly premeditated against us. Words that are designed to hurt us deliberately. And the pain is magnified when those hurtful words come from someone who is close to us. Could be from a child, a brother, a sister, parent, a spouse maybe. But that sort of insult pales into insignificance when compared to the insult that Jesus is telling us about in Luke chapter 20. If you want, you can describe this as the ultimate insult, because it's delivered not against fellow human beings, but rather the insult is delivered against a long-suffering God himself. This is the last parable, by the way, that Luke has in his gospel. It may even be the last parable that Jesus ever told. In fact, I should tell you, there are scholars out there who argue about whether this is a parable at all. Some scholars believe that this parable is more of an allegory, where, unlike the other parables, the meaning of this particular piece is barely hidden in the details of the story. Because certainly the scribes and the chief priests at the very end of the parable, they don't have any trouble at all knowing what this parable means. So let's take a look at it and see what Jesus has to teach us through this parable. You remember that just before this passage, Jesus told the parable of the 10 pounds just as he was about to enter Jerusalem. That parable of the 10 pounds, by the way, is very similar to the parable of the talents that we looked at a few weeks back. The setting is that Jesus has entered the city, like on Palm Sunday, with this great fanfare. And the first thing Jesus does when he comes into the city is what? He drives out the money changers and the merchants that were in the temple doing their merchandising, if you like. And this, of course, didn't make the Pharisees or the chief priests very happy, did they? Because likely, there's some proof maybe that they got a cut of that sales, whatever was going on in the temple. So they challenged him on where he gets his authority for an act like that, driving the money changers out. Demanding the source of authority is one of the first things that you and I, we do when we're confronted by someone telling us what to do. That's what I was trying to communicate to the children. Jesus' response is to not answer their question really. He turns the tables a little bit right back at them. He asked them how they understood John's baptism, John the Baptist. Was his baptism from heaven or was it of human origin? In other words, where did John's authority come from to baptize people like that in the Jordan? Well, that kind of put the religious leaders in a bit of a spin. And while they were fumbling about trying to come up with an answer, he tells them the story, the parable. He begins by saying, a man planted a vineyard. He leased it to tenants and he went away to another country for a long time. Now for Jesus' listeners, the mere mention of a vineyard would have rung loudly in their minds. The vineyard was a well-known Old Testament metaphor for the nation of Israel. In Isaiah 5, God tells Israel how he planted a vineyard, but when he came to harvest from it, he only found bad fruit. It was such a famous parable of the failure of Israel, that one in Isaiah. Jesus' hearers couldn't have helped but to think of it when they listened to what Jesus was talking about. The parable progresses. As it progresses, it becomes more and more clear that he's pointing the finger of criticism at those who were listening to him. Elsewhere, he accuses them of being no better than their forefathers who killed the prophets. And here he goes further by predicting that they will kill God's only son. You know, at first, the story only indicates their greed, their rudeness towards the owner. But as the story progresses, we find what is the true motivation for their incredible act of rebellion. It says in verse 14, but when the tenants saw the son, they discussed it amongst themselves and said, this is the heir. Let us kill him so that the inheritance is ours. The true motivation behind the actions is this. Although they had been placed in the vineyard as tenants, they didn't want to acknowledge the owner of the vineyard as the true owner. They wanted to be the owners of the vineyard. Now, the danger when we look at a parable like this is to see what Jesus is saying in the original context. That is, that the Jewish leaders have rejected God's rule over them and are about to reject God's son as well, and we just walk away from it. We think what terrible people those hypocritical chief priests and scribes were, and we think, well, that's all we really can learn from this. But that's to miss the actual sting of the parable. Because what Jesus is describing in this parable is the condition of every fallen human heart. The vineyard is no longer just a picture of Israel. It is a picture of the entire world. All of us have been put on this earth as tenants in God's vineyard. And what's our response? Well, we don't like being tenants, do we? We don't like paying rent. We want to be the owners. Adam and Eve were placed in the garden in the first place, weren't they? They were given the task of tending it, and what happened? They decided it would be good to be like God, knowing the difference between good and evil. Modern humans have been doing the same thing ever since. The people of Israel, from the moment God liberated them from Egypt, kept on turning away from the true worship of God to idols. Until eventually, what did God do? God expelled them from the promised land, didn't he? Sent them out into exile in Babylon. The king of Israel presented a long line of failure after failure to do what was right, with the odd exception in that list. And it's continued right through to our day. You know, 100 years ago, human philosophers were really at their golden age. And one of the things they said was that God was irrelevant. When poverty, disease, war, with good philosophy, these things would all disappear. Well, human advances in science and medicine and sociology, well, that would solve all the problems that we have. Well, 100 years later, we look around our world and we still see that incurable diseases are all around us. Wars are happening, it seems, without ceasing. Relationships are breaking down at an alarming rate. And we wonder, how in the world did things get this bad? What's gone wrong in God's vineyard? Well, the answer, well, it's pretty clear, isn't it? People are wanting to run the vineyard themselves and then follow God's direction. This is the root source of ecological problems in our world. Here are why millions are starving while a small number waste the world's food resources. Here's why the socialist dreams of communism failed to materialize. Here's why 40% of all marriages end in divorce. Why? Because no one wants to follow someone else's agenda. We want to be the owners. We don't want to be the tenants. You're not the boss of me, we used to say in the schoolyard. And I can just say that this is just as much a problem in the church as it is anywhere else. Someone was joking recently that one denomination's method of church growth is to have a fight and then split the church. But it isn't a joke, is it? How many new denominations or independent churches have sprung up in the past century this way? All because people did not want to follow someone else's lead. This is one particular true story of that such a situation. In Dwight Pentecost's commentary on the book of Philippians, he refers to an occurrence that split a church in Dallas, Texas. The church split was so bad that it eventually involved legal suit with one side of the church suing the other for who had the right of ownership to the church property. The case went all the way to the state Supreme Court. It was dismissed on the grounds that the state Supreme Court was not going to deal with some inner church issues, but they would have to be dealt with by the denominational body that governed that church. Well, fortunately, the matter was finally settled, with one side being given ownership rights of the property. But during this period, there was a local news reporter who was following all this drama and decided to investigate, well, what was really at the heart of all this? What started all this? He discovered that it all started at a church dinner. Apparently, one of the church elders was offended, when the portion of food given to him at the dinner was not as large as the young person sitting next to him. The whole church split because someone was offended over how much food they got. Now, as you listen to this parable, you notice two things. First, the insane insolence of the tenants. It's startling. This is a rebellion that you kind of knew was going to be doomed to failure. Yet they seem to think that they can get away with it. How can we puny creatures think we can shake our fist at God and not suffer consequences? How can we go on rejecting anything and anyone that God sends us to remind us of the debt that we owe him? And think we can get away with it. There's no way God will put up with that sort of thing. Here's the second interesting thing to discover. The amazing thing about this story is that the owner, that is God, tolerates the rebellion for so long. Here's the amazing thing about the biblical story. God's incomprehensible concern for you and I. The lengths that God will go to keep us on track, to maintain contact with us, despite our stubbornness and our blind ignorance. And of course, the length that God will go to by sending his own son as a rescue mission. That was Jesus' mission, to save us. You see, the response of the owner to the repeated refusal to listen to his envoys is to decide to send his own son. In a last attempt to talk reason to them. Now notice how Jesus at this point answers the question about authority posed by the chief priest back in verse 2 as he identifies himself as the Son, as the unique, the beloved Son of God. And notice that the claim is as important today as it was in Jesus' day. There are still people in the church today who downplay or even deny the deity of Jesus. I heard the other day about someone who wrote about a time when his father was talking to the local minister, commenting on the difficulty he was having with the idea of Jesus' resurrection. And the minister replied, "That's okay, I have the same trouble. In fact, I don't really believe in the resurrection happening at all." Well, what sort of a state is the church in if its leaders don't believe the deity of Jesus? The leaders of Jesus' day didn't, of course, and as a result, they put him to death. One can only think that if Jesus came today, his end would have been the same. Rejected by those he came to save, put to death because we didn't want to submit to God's authority, because we wanted to be the owners, not the tenants. What's clear in this story is that Jesus understands what awaits him at the end of the week that this parable occurs in. He's clearly predicting his death at the hands of those God has put in charge of his nation. But equally clear is Jesus' understanding of the long-term future. He knows that the eternal gospel doesn't allow for anyone to run the vineyard except God himself. Listen to how the angels in Revelation 14 announce the eternal gospel. "Then I saw another angel," John writes, "flying in mid-heaven with the eternal gospel to proclaim to those who live on the earth, to every nation and tribe and language and people. He said in a loud voice, 'Fear God and give him glory, for the hour of judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water.'" The eternal gospel, which had been proclaimed from the very beginning, right through to the end, is this. God is to be worshipped and glorified. He is the only God. You know, we're all judged every day, you and I. We are judged by the face that looks back at us from the mirror when we wake up in the morning. We're judged by the faces of the people we love and by the faces and lives of our children and also by our dreams. We are judged by the faces of people that we don't really know and don't love. And each day finds us at the junction of many roads, and we are judged as much by the roads we have not taken as the ones we have. The New Testament proclaims that at some unforeseeable time in the future, God will rain down the final curtain on history. And there will come a day on which all our days and all our judgments upon us and all our judgments upon each other will themselves be judged. And that judge will be Jesus. In other words, the one who judges us most finally will be the one who loves us most fully. You know, romantic love is blind to everything except what is lovable and lovely. But Christ's love sees us with terrible clarity. He sees our wholeness. Christ's love so wishes our joy that it is ruthless against anything that diminishes our joy. The worst sentence love can pass is that we behold the suffering of our Lord and what he endured for our sake and what he also did for our acquittal. The justice and mercy of the judge are ultimately one. One. So it is that God's servants still come to the vineyard, urge us to produce some good fruit. Do we listen? Do we send them away? Do we injure them in some way because we refuse to accept their call in our lives? So it is the Son of God still comes, still pleads with us to recognize whose vineyard this is. And our presence and whatever rewards we receive while we toil in this vineyard, we're here because of the grace of God, the one who owns the vineyard. The stone which was rejected by Israel, by countless generations of people and many people today, is in fact the cornerstone, the source of strength and stability for everything that is good and full of hope lies with him. And that truth ultimately cost Jesus his life, also that we can know life and know it in abundance.